It is May 21st, 2014, and today's interview is taking place in the office of Jack McMillan at Home Hardware on Memorial Avenue. And Jack, if I just have you introduce yourself and just broadly give your connection to an interest in the grain industry in Thunder Bay.
Sure, certainly. My name is Jack McMillan. I'm the son of Malcolm McMillan, who was a General Superintendent of Manitoba Pool Elevators number 9 and number 2. Previously, it was Alberta Pool. I really, my interest in it actually started from a perspective of getting summer employment, which I was fortunate enough to procure during my high school and university days. So my perspective really is what sort of went on during the summer months and how we got there and exactly what was going on with the students at that time. So one of the first things I'd like to say is that it was a period of high employment. So there was a lot of students in the summer. There was no part, and also there was no part-time people. It was all, when you were hired as a student, you were hired as a full-time employee. Your wage at 18 years of age was the same wage as a gentleman working beside you who had a family of three. There was no lack of work at that in those months, that those years. That was from about 1965 through to about 1972. Usually, depending on the elevator, you worked 5 days a week, sometimes 3 nights a week overtime from 6 to 9, and Saturdays at time and a half for 8 hours. That was quite normal in the early summer. Spring, and then after that, it would have continued. It would have been more for some of the gentlemen because a lot of the students obviously got back to school. So that was my first introduction to the grain elevators, where my father got me a job. But I think most of, as I see, most of the students, and a lot of them were my personal friends who were hired there. It was very, very nepotism was very, very strong. Whether you were working for the government or you were working for the private elevators, it really was a matter of who you knew. And
What year was this? Sorry, Chris.
we're looking around 1965 through to about 1972. I mean, and there was really no shortage of jobs at that time for students.
You were born in Thunder Bay?
Born and raised in Thunder Bay, yeah. My
And
father was came over as a first generation from Scotland, the Isle of Lewis.
You have the nice perspective of being able to have two generations in your mind, your what you can recall about your dad and his involvement, and as you said, the emphasis on the students. So let's go back and talk about your dad. And I understand, you know, that that's asking to go back a fair bit. But when we first talked about doing this interview, you had mentioned something about how sort of people found jobs in the elevators, not the students, but the actual.
I can, a lot of them, it was like a wave. First of all, it was a wave of immigrants from the British Isles that came over. And a lot of them came over, particularly, if this is what we're mentioning about, is a lot of them came over to play in the pipe bands. And because of that, there were a lot of superintendents in Winnipeg and in Thunder Bay who were of Scottish descent, and they wanted to prop the pipe bands up. So there was quite an influx of Scottish immigrants, particularly from the Isle of Lewis, that were great bagpipe players, and some are still alive today. And they helped McGilvery and Fort William pipe bands out. And one of the other things I in mentioning my father was that in his early years, being a British immigrant, unions were very strong in his forefront, and he was he helped, from my understanding, help organize the first brotherhood of grain handlers with a group of people. He eventually left the union to become a management position, but he was a very strong union person, and it became strong down the on the waterfront.
Did he ever talk about those early days of union organizing? I think there
No.
was probably a wave in the 19 early 19th century, so this or 20th century, the 1910s, 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that may have fizzled out a bit, and then he would have been involved in the next round?
The next round, yeah. It was more of his era, I would say.
Did you ever sense that he had a...
Service center, line one, please. Service, line one.
That he had sort of split loyalties, having moved into management?
No, not whatsoever, because I think back then unions were perhaps a little bit different. They weren't, they became stronger, and I personally think they were, had something to do with a little bit of the flow of grain to Thunder Bay, but I can particularly remember one summer when I was in university, I had to seek work out of town, that the elevators were on strike. So my father, I would perhaps deliver lunch to my father because he had to be there and look after it, but the men on the line never gave any problems. He would make them coffee, bring them coffee. They would come in, have a coffee. So there was really no animosity, there's no split division, because they'd all, at that time, they'd all come through the elevators. Like, you'd come through the ranks, you shoveled grain, you learned how to clean it, how to process it, and then you went into management. So there wasn't a lot of people directly from university taking over as managers. It was, you worked yourself up. And so there was no split loyalties that I personally could tell.
Did you get a sense that he liked his job?
Very much, yeah. Because if you, at that time, and I was just recollecting that there was, because it was good employment, and there was, the wages were, I would say, fairly good, there was no, I don't, there's no animosity at those workplaces. They all knew each other. They would probably more than occasionally have beers with each other. They would socially, in terms of maybe after work, get together. It was fairly harmoniously. There was no bullying that I knew of. There was, people just got along. It was just a different era. And he enjoyed his job. Yeah, he enjoyed it.
Now, did he ever... talk about, especially when you started working, you became more familiar with what was actually done in the elevator. Did he ever talk about the old days and, you know, how oftentimes your parents say, oh, you know, you have it so easy. Back in the old days, I can remember.
I'm going to say not really. I mean, he passed on the idea that you had to work hard to get ahead. Because you got the job because of nepotism doesn't necessarily mean that you would you could slack off. In fact, anybody who worked for their parents knew that they had to be the hardest working person. I won't say I was there, but usually you had to toe the line pretty good. My father was his last few years of working there when I was working, because he was they started a family later at that time because of the war. So.
So you said that your dad was the supervisor at Pool 2 and
yeah,
9.
Yeah, Pool 9 and 2, right.
And that's where you worked?
I worked at
mostly?
Pool 9, Pool 2, and later on during university I worked at Manitoul Pool 1, which was more automated, and Pool number 3, which were more automated. Pool 9 and Pool 2 at that time, in terms of emptying grain cars, it was a matter of physically taking a wooden shovel, not a grain shovel, but it was a piece of plywood 3 feet by 4 foot, physically going into a grain car and shoveling it out. And that's what they called shoveling boxcars. Manitoul Pool 1 had an automatic dumper at that time, and Pool 3 was much the same. So when you worked in Manitoul Pool 2 and Manitoul Pool 9 and some, like, say, Parrish and Hambecker and some of the other elevators on Cam River, it was physical work. Mm. And you're expected so many boxcars a day to shovel. And if you're fortunate enough to shovel those, whether your quota was 9 or 10, you're also allowed to go home too.
Let's. I was commenting on which elevators that your dad worked with, mm-hmm. because I thought they may be the ones you're more familiar with. So you talked about there being a wave of British Isles, largely Scottish, mm-hmm. Gaelic speaking.
The ones from Isle of Lewis were definitely Gaelic speaking. There was a good friend of mine whose parents were from Stornoway, would say that a lot of them would immigrate over with an F stamped on their head, which meant when you went to Fort William Elevator F, which was on the Cam River. So there was a great many Scots over in Westford area too. So. So yeah, the first wave I would say was British, and the second wave that I thought when I was there were Italians, and those names are, you know, they're familiar with us. A lot of them in construction area endeavors, their children and grandchildren, Arbelas, Scotias, De Gregarios, Tulares, they all worked in the elevators and Medeos, and they just. That was the second wave. There was obviously other ethnic groups, but those two seemed to be the Scots, like the British Isles and the Italians were.
That you were familiar with. Did it stack up by floor? Like certain nationalities worked on certain floors, or?
There was that there, absolutely. I when I think back, Italians would start in the car sheds, and British immigrants were, unfortunately, they were probably on the scale floor, on the bin floors. It did obviously change because there people were passing on, and those things did change. Could we just stop for 1 second? Important. There we go. Sorry. Okay.
Thanks.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
So you were saying?
I was saying, yes. I would say the first wave of Italians after the British Isles were expected to, or did work in the unloading cars. There was a difference. There was, I would say that.
How much of that would be, could you put down to language barriers, the sort of splitting?
I would say that was high. It was perhaps 80%, at least. So I think it was when one brother, I know specifically, when one brother joined the elevators, he would tell his other two or three brothers. There was many families. Like, there was always, I just know from some of the names that I mentioned, Scotias, there was two or three, and Arelas, there was two or three, always brothers or cousins. I don't know, but there was, once a family was entrenched there, then the rest of their family knew they could work there as well.
How do you spell that? Arelas, was it?
Arela, A-R-E-L-L-A, and Scotia, S-C-O-C-H-I-A, Scotia.
So by the time you got the students working, they would be kids of both, of all nationalities?
No, never. And most students were, like I say, students, so there was no issues there.
Yeah. Do you recall the first time you ever went in an elevator? Was it with your dad when you were a kid?
Yeah, I went down to, he went probably went down to check on a boat, see what was being loaded, if it was finished. And I remember just walking in there, and that thing that probably struck you most was that it was dusty and it was dirty, in terms of just being so much dust from the grain dust. I mean, they did have filters, but it was nothing that would be, you would see today. That was my first impression. And just the smell of the grain, you could smell it. And then days in the spring when the shipping season opened up, there was, living in Port Arthur, when the boats were being loaded, you could actually smell it from the shores of Lake Superior up to around High Street where you were. It was just that you knew that the season was beginning. So that's my recollection of going there.
Yeah. Did you find them?
In the basement, it was dark and damp and critters. And yeah, as a young boy, it was a little bit scary, a little spooky. Yeah, you had to be with an adult. One of my other jobs was because I continued on during my university days, was being a day-night watchman, and I would just go around, and they had different clock positions for insurance purposes. You would check the basements, certain floor areas, and you'd punch a clock, which was given to insurance companies after to make sure things were correct. So, yeah, that was it was a different area. Plus, there was another culture going on too, and that was when grain cars were finished, unloaded, and pushed out onto the tracks, there was a group of people that would take the plywood out of the cars, and that was used for homes, and some would sweep the cars out that was left over and bag it and sell it back to, I don't know.
Sanctioned?
No, it was not sanctioned. But they knew pretty much all the individuals who were doing it. It was sort of left aside. I mean, getting the excess grain, was not an issue because it was just going to go back. But taking all the plywood out of the cars was probably an issue the grain companies didn't, or the transportation companies didn't like for sure.
Because they say they did a lot of retrofitting of...
Oh, it was, huge. I bet a lot of homes in Westford, don't know personally, but I knew a lot were, you know, those grain doors were used for everything. Wall sheathing, roof sheathing, floor sheathing, yeah. And actually at that time, the plywoods used in there wasn't rough plywood that we know. It was usually like a good one side fir or, you know, expensive grade of plywood.
So these would actually be the walls, not the doors of the cars?
The walls of the cars, yeah. I think grain cars were formed or lined with plywood sheets.
And
He survived the blast of Sasspool 6, where the waterfront development is right now. Not really that he would say so much, because I didn't really ask him. I mean, my own thoughts and recollections were of when I worked there myself. And one of the other things you have to remember is that the elevators were so strong and there were so many people employed that they had their own hockey leagues, they had their own baseball leagues, it was just... those are the things I remember.
Did you ever play in those?
Both.
Okay, yeah, we'll come back to that. Sure. And I'm trying to actually track down some photographs, because a couple of people have mentioned the leagues, and it would be really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if I have any of the hockey team I might have picked.
So you said mid-60s was when you started actually working.
Yep.
In the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
So... can you describe your first day, or as much as a composite of your first few days?
Mm-hmm. First days, I had to work shoveling boxcars. And there was a certain method that you used to have a large steel pulley that would pull this door that you would hold on to and scoop the grain out of the car and into the hoppers. And personally, I couldn't get the hang of it. They call riding it. It was like almost like surfing on grain. And I ended up breaking the shovels all the time. Like, they're hardwood shovels. So I know they're millwrights, and just to save on cost, just so I would. And then from there, I would go into the basement, and there's conveyor belts that brought the grain up, but what you had to do is make sure that there was all the grain was swept up and it was cleaned up. So that was the second part. And then as you became more adverse, you'd get up to the scale floor. That was after about a year or so. In the second or third year, I would work on the scale floor, which was a job just measuring grain with a grain scaler from the government. We're weighing grain that was going onto the boats. So those were kind of jobs you kind of look forward to. You're, like, that was your seniority. But most times you had to start at the very bottom.
So the students had seniority as well?
They didn't, but I mean, if you were a student, had there was no seniority rights for students. They got the same wage and everything, but there's no seniority rights. But you, after your, you know, second, third, fourth year, you've been there. You know, they knew what you're capable of, and so there was turnover. 7, and then go to Stewart's elevator, if it so be, because everybody was looking for people at that time. It was labor intensive, so you shouldn't have been without a job. And so there was turnover. So if you knew something about the workings of the inside of the elevator, you're up there. So. And also, it did have to do with nepotism.
Now, when your first days on the job, especially the job with the shoveling, how did you feel that night and the day after?
You're exhausted. You're exhausted. They would give you a mask to help you with the dust, but quite honestly, it didn't really do much. And you couldn't breathe. It was so hot. You couldn't breathe, and you had to take it off, and your eyes would swell up, your nostrils would be full of grain dust, and you go home and have supper that your mother had prepared, and probably crash. That was it. It was not much, you know. Friday, Saturday was different, but Monday to Thursday.
A Charles Atlas or the kid who got the dust kicked in his or the sand kicked in his eyes? Where were you on the?
In terms of,
well, how big were you as a kid?
I was large at that time. 6 foot, 6 foot one was considered a, you know, I was, yeah, I was fully grown at that time, and you know, it was physical work, but just the same, was more than what you had been doing.
Yeah. Did you ever get the hang of the shovel?
No, I never did. But there was some that could almost, honestly, it was unbelievable how fast they could do it. It was just there and unbelievable.
You mentioned earlier on the tape about you were sort of given a number of cars to do in a day.
Yeah, and one of the other things that Manitoba Pool 9 was that in the winter months, they would use coal as their source of heat for offices. And one of the things I never got to do, my good friends did, was to go in and shovel the box of coal, a box car of coal, into the bins. And it was filthy dirt. You were given rest. It wasn't like it was they weren't taking advantage of you. You weren't expected to do more cars and just keep going. There was a reasonable audit. You always had time for lunch. I always had an hour lunch. I always had a coffee break and water breaks. And so there was no pressure of trying to get X amount of cars done a day. You know, there was a quota. Not really a quota. It wasn't stated that perhaps if you and your crew, there was usually two lines or two rail lines coming in, and so there was a bit of a race on first to get to lunch. So if you finished 11:30, you'd go to lunch 11:30, come back at 1, and if you finished at 4:30, you clean up and go home at 5. And you, I remember you're always pretty much finished by 4:30 because they gave you time to clean up and get ready to go home. So it was a good place to work. Yep. In the small elevators, Manitoba Pool was small. There was only perhaps two or three of us. But as I moved to pool number 1 and pool 3, which were large elevators at that time, there was maybe 10 students. So you're always with students. A lot of times they were your friends because they were just... That's who got hired, and it was enjoyable because it'd just be friends. And I would say that most of the people surviving. So I've been in business almost 40 years myself. That they're still customers of mine. They actually come in. They still come in today, which is 2014. That's a long time. So I would say that because of the relationship you had down there, it was just everybody was there to work but have a little bit of a good time, that it just carried on.
Was it?
Absolutely. Well, there was layoffs in the winter, so, but when I was working there, it was from May through to end of August. It was extremely busy. Yeah.
So the days went fast?
Very fast. Yeah, very fast. And when you're doing that type of work, yes, yeah, for sure.
Did you spend any time talking to the old timers? And do they have any words of wisdom or stories to pass on about their?
A lot were my relatives, so we had some things to talk of. I would say that the grain trade was really picking up at that time. The 60s, it seemed to be a period of really gangbusters. It was just, I guess, there was lots going to Russia at that time before the credit crunch, and there was a lot of shipments. So there was picking, and they would just say how it was hard. Like, it was, I mean, it was before even pulleys and stuff like that. So it was it was hard work at that time, and it was dusty and often dangerous because of the explosions, pool 4 explosions. I think pool 6 explosion. There was some in Fort William, I'm not sure, but it was a dangerous place to work because of the grain dust, for sure. So they would recount those stories, sort of. Some who had escaped, some who you knew that were permanently scarred from it.
So you actually...
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Saw some of the people who had...
Yeah, survived, yeah. Yeah.
Did they tell stories of the day?
No.
And why they stayed on?
I think that time, people were just... They wanted to make sure that their families were looked after, so it was as a matter of continuing to work. Safety issues were always there, but it was never... there was no health and safety coordinator. There was no real, that I'm aware of, there was no real safety procedures in a lot of cases to do. It was just common sense. And you were reprimanded if you would cross like a belt or, but in a lot of times it was never explained to you. You were just expected to learn it and pick it up. So a lot of the old grain trades stories, I'd say, and their time was spent lunch hours, resting and playing cards, and that was about it.
Drinking was a fair issue that a number of people that we've interviewed had mentioned. Was that something that you would see as a student, or that was done?
Something that I would see as a student.
Or take part in?
You were expected to participate. You were expected to... on a Saturday night, you're expected to put in a couple of dollars for a case of beer, amongst maybe 8 or so. I personally couldn't be involved, but I had to give money because I just didn't want my father to find out. Alcohol was an issue at those times. I mean, I can remember literally in some elevators, one gentleman knew we would drink all day. So, yeah, there was some.
Did it affect the work, or were they sort of?
They were pushed aside. They were all functioning, I would say. They were sort of pushed aside into a job that they could handle. It wasn't open by any chance. It was known, and I think that because most of the superintendents had worked with everybody, had worked their way through, they understood that sometimes there was relief needed. But I think. There was abuse of alcohol because drugs weren't really that big at that time, but alcohol was really it was heavily involved in.
Do you have can you speculate why you think that was? And I don't know that it was exclusive to the grain elevators either.
No, oh, absolutely not. If you were caught smoking or drinking in the elevator, caught by the superintendents or the general foremen, then you were reprimanded. So it wasn't too hard in a big complex to avoid those people and to take advantage of it. It was in the spirit of, if you're working a Saturday night, well, it was kind of like, you should be out with your family enjoying it, or your wife in those cases. And so they probably had one or two. Absolutely, they would expect to do it. But it's, if you were there, you were expected to participate, and you were expected to say nothing. as just the way it is. I mean, so, but it was not tolerated but accepted.
So an unwritten code of silence, in a sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
Did that ever affect some people staying and not staying? You said that, you know, there was a fair bit of turnover with the students. Do you think that, or just the physical surroundings and the discomfort of working with grain were more issues?
I think that was the issue. I don't think anybody, any young student wasn't really, especially the university, wasn't really concerned about the drinking that was going on, because they were doing most of that themselves. So, no, it was more of an issue of physical labor, probably. A lot would just stay on, and it was
important. Did you have a favorite job?
I would say being on the scale floor was probably my favorite, because it was relatively easy. You worked in there was an actual office upstairs where the scale floor was, so they would shipping and receiving how much grain was coming in and how it was going out. That was a job, you know, took a little bit more thinking than it did just brawn. So I enjoyed that. I also enjoyed as a summer student is working at Pool 1 with the cars, because you're outside all the time. You were really, a lot of times, one of the jobs I had was to, once the car had been emptied, the next car would shunt up to it and you'd push it down the line and it would just kind of take off, and you're expected to put the brakes on and just like lock the cars together. I would say 30% of the time the brakes didn't work, so you had to jump off it, and that wasn't an elevator issue. That was a rail issue. If you're a student in the summertime, it was 70 or 75 out. It was nice to be outside. Absolutely.
Did that job entail you going on the top of the cars, or?
Climbing up a ladder in the back, and then there was like a big steering wheel at the top, if I remember right. So you weren't physically on top of it; you're on the end of it, on the ladder. And more than one time, there was somebody sweeping grain out inside the other cars, so they were in for a mild shock when that was happening. So yeah, I'd get heck from the guy inside the cleaning it out. That I was not bringing them up soft enough for them. So,
but this would have been one of the official cleaners, not the ones you were mentioning.
No, it was unofficial cleaners. So they were cleaning up the cars. One other thing is just I look back at it, and you asked me to think a bit about it. I look around the block in my I lived in Rattan and Farron Street area. And on that block, within two blocks, I had counted 9 people that were involved in the grain trade, 9 or 10 people involved in the grain trade at millwrights, electricians, my father's superintendent. It was the head grain trimmer.
Can you put names to those people?
Yep.
Would you? We had, do you know Gene Onchalenko at all?
Yes. Yeah, he was, he worked for Manitou Pool. And I knew him from photography,
right,
where he took a lot of pictures of the ships. Yeah, yeah, that was his big thing. Yeah.
And he grew up in Westport, and he said same thing. If he had a paper route, and if he remembered that here, and how they were connected. So it's really nice to have that. So go ahead.
I just remember on Rattan Street, a block between Wolseley and it would be Meek Street. There was Van Horn in between. So there was my father, who worked at Manitou Pool. There was a Bill Krelchuk, whose father was a millwright at SAS Pool 4. Bill Krelchuk, who worked and finished up working at Pool 4. There was Ray Pierce, whose son Larry became a teacher. He worked as an electrician at Pool 7. There was my uncle Evander, who worked for United Grain Growers. He was on Van Horn. There was Emerson Squires, who was general superintendent of Manitou Pool Elevators. There was John McCrae, who was a millwright at Stewart. There was Mr. Trist, I don't know, can't remember quite where he was. There was Dennis Accent, who worked for Manitoula Pool, and Murray Smith, who worked for Manitoula Pool. So very, very short. There was like 9, 10 people within a block and a half that were working the grain elevators and further down. This was just my neighborhood, so there was a lot of people involved in that, yeah, for sure.
And they would be walking distance because cars were, you know, not
a lot of them didn't even have licenses. There was carpooling, absolutely. There was carpooling. I remember most of the members, Mr. Pierce being dropped off, Mr. McRae being dropped off. My uncle never drove. He would always carpool. So obviously when you have a large population just working the elevators, it was easy to get a ride. And they would just carpool, yeah. So one person would be fortunate enough to have a car, and two or three would always get a ride home.
What was the access to the waterfront at that time? Was the overpass there already?
The overpasses, Pool 1 and 3 was there, and Manitoula Pool was down McDougal Street. But that's been closed. Or Pool 9, excuse me. That has been closed off, yeah.
Yeah, so they have the overpass at Current River, so that would have taken you into Pool 9. And
there was no, it was, you're over top, you're going over about 6 or 7 tracks at that time. There was no overpass. Mm. There is no overpass there, I don't think. I can't. No, there's no overpass.
Oh, right,
there.
No, right.
No.
Yeah, no. That's the railway bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the river goes under.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. So gotcha. It was all, yeah. Yeah, it was in, personally, I would even walk sometimes. Manitoula Pool 2, which is at the bottom of the street, I would walk to work.
What was your interaction with the railway people? Anything? Was it just sort of a nice, what the term they used to say, seamless coordination with the railways and the elevators?
Yeah, there was, as a student, there was no interaction at all. The only ones I would remember were subcontractors like Bazook Railway, who would hire usually CP, CN. That grew into a very large business.
Maintain the tracks on the elevator property?
On the elevator property, yeah, on the elevator property. They would just, they just maintain them.
Mm.
So it was Bill Bazook Sr. and then Bill Bazook Jr. and Bruce Bazook.
Were there ever any accidents or incidents that you recall from your student years?
Well, a grain car is going over. It was a major issue. Going over the end of the trestle. So they would be back up. The night they would perhaps load 30 cars. I don't know what the number was. So if somebody lost count, and when my good friend John Atwood was there, he would say that he'd be counting 28, 29. Somebody would lose count, and there'd be one over into the. That happened more than once. It was almost a common occurrence. Yeah. So.
Who took?
Oh, that was responsibility.
Responsibility for that.
It was the railway's responsibility. And these are full cars. These are full cars. And they ride over. Usually just one would go over, and then they would have to usually get a salvage company to either, I think Thunder Bay Harbor had a big crane, and they might lift it up out of there. But, yeah, that was it wasn't a common occurrence. It was something that you knew it was going to happen. Other than that, there was a tragedy, definitely. I remember one student was severely injured, not with railway cars. It was cars themselves. It wasn't really so much happening in the elevators. It was the rail cars, because they're just, the machinery is so big that sometimes you just couldn't escape what was happening.
Hmm. What about the ships? Did you pay any attention to the ships coming in? Did this world of grain?
Yeah, especially when a salty would come over. That was rather, that was always interesting. There was it was like a mini business that would happen there too. I always relate back, because if a salty came in, there was always some sort of goods that were for sale. But it was...
For example?
Liquor. Always seemed to come back to that. Yeah, really. That was always cigarettes, like European cigarettes. Most of the time, when I'd like to see what type of ship, whether it was the Patterson's, which Patterson ship would come in, Canada Steamship Lines. You would know, if you worked in elevators, you'd pretty well know most ship lines that were coming in. You wouldn't necessarily know who was on them, but you would definitely know the Senator of Canada, the Manitoba dock, Ont dock, just the Fort William, I think that might have been a Canada Steamship Lines. You could just tell by the profile outside the breakwater waiting to come in which ship it was. I always could always tell that. It was interesting that way, yeah. It's still interesting today just to go down the harbor and see them.
Let me just take a moment to take a quick look at my official questions.
All right.
To see. What about the grain inspection and the sampling? Did you have any
connection there? I did it for the company. So the company would have their own grain inspection division. So you would take samples from each car that came into the elevator and bring it up to our own inspection department. And the same with the government employees would have their samplers and their grain inspectors, and weighmen were always on. They usually had their own offices there. So, I had some interaction with most of them, but it was always a pleasant, you're always, you know, they're held in high regard when I was there. Like, they're in the inspection department with the government, you know, that was considered a good job, you know, really.
Was there a them and us kind of attitude at all?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember any issues where they had to, of course I wouldn't know if they had to downgrade a grade of wheat or barley. I don't know those issues there at all. Mm. But also you have to remember too in the summertime that, I don't know if you remember about it, but there was grain elevator tours. They always had tourism, Thunder Bay or Fort William, Port Arthur always had what they called ambassadors, and they'd always have, there's usually tours of the elevator almost at least once or twice a week. So that was always interesting from a perspective.
Did you take the tour sometimes? Like
a couple of times I was expected to take them around the elevator. So that was part of the kind of just leisurely walk around and, you know, take it easy for a while. Yeah, that was always interesting, that one.
Any recollections of where the people would have been from?
Mostly the prairies. Mostly.
Busmen.
Wanted to see where their grain was going, pretty much. And, they used to call them money makers. They were, that's where they would take an off grade and sift it and sort it and make a good grade out of it. But unfortunately, I believe that the farmer was always given the short end there. So they came down. They wanted to know how it was processed and where it was going and how it was done. Yeah, I'd say majority was Manitoba, Saskatchewan. Mm.
One of the things about our project that I guess has that I've learned, you know, starting out from far, how highly developed the whole system is, from putting the seed in the ground to having it turn up as a
loaf of bread.
Pita somewhere,
yeah.
Or a loaf of bread.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any sense of being part of that system?
Not at that time, no. It was, I would say it didn't cross our minds at the time. It didn't cross my mind for some reason. It was just a product coming in and going out. It was grain. It was just grain. And I couldn't say that. I thought it was a big picture. I wasn't involved with that part of it, no.
Mm-hmm.
No, just.
Yeah, very insular.
Yeah, very, yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Just get it out of the car and into a boat. That was what it was about. Yeah.
What would you say would be your fondest memories?
I'm going to have to say, as a student, it was just camaraderie. The lasting relationships so long, you know, just, you know, people that were, they worked there just their living, and, you know, most students went on to go to university, graduate, and but they were just, in Manitoba Pool, I would say, just, they're just a great bunch of guys. And,
we talked a little bit about the hockey league. Tell me a bit about that.
It was quite developed in so much that there was outside sponsors all the time. Like there would be, I remember once in Lumbard sponsored the Manitoba Pool team. There was United Grain Growers had their own team. They had, and there was it was senior, like a senior contact, but there was body contact for sure. There was some good hockey players. There was ex-professional players that came to play. I remember Eddie Catcher, Mike Catcher. Eddie Catcher played in the NHL. They'd all come back and play, and Caruso's, and there was good hockey players.
At a certain point, it was almost like, you know, bringing in the Pipers from Scotland. Mm-hmm. They would hire people in order to beef up their hockey teams.
That could have been. I was almost. I continued playing in university and after university for a while. The league had developed past. It wasn't just obviously couldn't support four or five teams just with elevator hockey personnel. So there was a lot of other people that weren't hockey players or didn't work at the elevators. But I'd say 80% were for sure.
Was there a team that was sort of dominant or shifted? Year to year,
Manitoba team I played for was a good team because we had ex professional. United Grain Growers had a real strong team. I can remember. I just remembering about this Roy Lemour, who's president of the Legion now. That's his going as was we called him the Silver Fox, and he was an excellent hockey player. Yeah, just excellent.
Was he an elevator employee or a railway employee?
I thought he worked for Saskatchewan Wheat Pool.
Oh, okay.
That was my understanding, yeah. Yeah, he was a
silver...
Yeah, Silver Fox, they called him, yeah. Yeah, because of his age. You know, we were 20 and he was 50, and he was better than us. So he was a good hockey player.
Did they have cups?
They did. I can't remember what it was called. They had a playoffs and a... I don't know if there was a specific cup for it, but yeah, they did have playoffs, and then they would play off against other leagues within the city sometimes. So, but I can't remember that one.
And where would they play?
We played a lot out of Grandview Gardens, Port Arthur Arena, and Fort William Gardens. Hmm.
Yeah. Did they ever play on the slips?
Not that I'm aware of.
No.
No. I remember a few people driving into the slips, but
no. Driving into the slips.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just for fun?
I think alcohol. Yeah.
Okay. Any questions I should have asked that I haven't asked you? Do you want to check your notes and see if there were some things there that... What was your uncle's last? Was it your father's... brother or your mother's?
My father's brother was Evander, and my mother's father was Hamilton, and he was a grain inspector. Henry Hamilton. So there was, again, it was perhaps my father, I don't know, he never told me whether he might have got his job from through my grandfather. Never said, but again, there was just so many people from the British Isles. It's hard to believe that somebody else didn't.
Yeah,
there wasn't reason.
So on your mom's side, then
he was transferred from Winnipeg to Thunder Bay. So he
as an inspector.
As an inspector, yeah.
And
yeah.
Did he work in the elevators or at the head office?
I'm thinking it would have been in the elevators. Yeah, it wasn't at the post office that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And when you just mentioned that, there was a lot of people from the grain inspector who were also on our hockey teams, as I remember, because it was a young group. And it was a large fraternity there, too. Yeah.
Speaking of fraternity, did they hire any women in your era, or that was pre?
I don't remember one. Don't remember one person, no. The only ones that would go through the elevators would be the tour guides. And that's probably why a lot of students want to make sure they're available to take them through. Sort of.
Oh, young man, so predictable.
Yeah, really. Alcohol and women, I don't know. I don't think so, Nancy. I just hope that your group gets done what they have to do. So it'd be interesting if we can just preserve an elevator somewhere.
Yeah, we'll have to get your gang of compatriots from the student league together at some point.
And yeah, well,
we'll have a work party.
There was a, when I worked at Manitoba Pool 2 in one of the buildings, an outbuilding, there was a working replica of an elevator, which I would say would stand, it was perhaps 8 feet long and 3 or 4 feet high. It obviously has gone missed, but it was a working model. It was beautiful.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wonder where it went.
I don't know. I think there was a steward who operated a tug service right out of there, beside Manitoba Pool 2, and that might have been on his. He might have bought that building. So yeah, would have been a nice
yes
thing to pick up, really. And like I said before, off camera, I had Nelson Merrifield, I believe, might have worked in the elevators too. He did a lot of shots of the elevators, and I had the shot of the first salty that came into through the seaway. But somebody left it at work, somebody took it.
Hmm. Yeah. Is he still around?
No.
No.
No, he's long gone, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a well-known photographer.
Yeah, I wonder where he is. Merrifield.
I wonder if
a collection might have gone to the museum. Maybe check that out sometime. Because, you know, a lot of stuff has gone to the museum, and because mm-hmm. they're so sparsely staffed, it's not been cataloged, and it just sort of sits there until somebody mm-hmm. gets mm-hmm. to it. So, mm-hmm. well, if any of your stuff does surface, let me know.
It's an interesting. It also shows who negotiated for the companies.
Oh, did it? Yeah, and it shows the companies that were involved. Were active at that time. Yeah. And that's. Do they even say? A lot of these things have everything except the year that it was.
Well, the contract year is there, so.
69.
Okay.
Yeah, duplicate is 1969. Okay, we'll add that to our collection. And with that, I'll officially end the interview, and thank you so much for sharing
thank
your
you.
Stories.
Thank you.
And remembrances of your dad.
Yeah.